You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Welcome to Unemployed Workers Fight Back.
Join your hosts Anne
and Kevin, that's me,
the second and fourth Friday of each month on The Sewer Show.
Between 5.30 and 6.30pm.
Here on 3CR Community Radio.
This is a show where we explore macroeconomic solutions
for the unemployed and underemployed.
Everyone in our community has value. Welcome to Unemployed Workers Fight Back. Anne, how are you doing?
Hello, Kevin. How are you? And hello to our intrepid listeners, Larry and Larissa. Thanks for joining us for another hour, Kevin, as we meander through the national economy.
I'm going to undo the magic of radio here just a little bit, Anne.
No, behind the scenes.
Well, so what happens is sometimes we come in live to the studio, and other times we can't make it, so we do a pre-record.
Mm-hmm.
And for the last few weeks, you have been producing these excellent pre-records, and they're silky smooth shows. All the regular listeners would know that if it's a silky smooth show, it's probably Anne. Has pre-recorded that one.
Mucked around there, yep.
And it was a bit rough around the edges. It's probably, you know, because we're live in the studio. But we haven't been able to come in for a while because I've been away travelling.
Where have you been, Kevin?
did you pay any attention on the news a little while ago to a certain festival?
I certainly did remember there was some rainfall in a certain festival.
Splendour in the Mud. Splendour in the Mud. It was, I thought I'd go and have a look and... I've got to say,
How did that work out for you?
Now, I like going to festivals. You know me, I'm a bit of a festival, mm-hmm. festival, what's the right word? Festival junkie? Was that the right word? I don't know. Festival attendee.
Connoisseur?
Splendour in the Mud was terrible.
Even without the rain?
Look, it was terrible on many fronts. By the day that it was supposed to start on the Friday proper, I got there on the Thursday with the rest of the campers, and by Thursday evening, we were up to our ankles literally in mud. If you didn't have gumboots, you were in serious trouble. And the place was a disaster zone by the end of Thursday night, and it didn't change for the whole festival. It was just rubbish. Like how it ever got got the tick of approval to start, I don't know. But then apart from that, like I like my festivals small and one stage and get to know everybody in the crowd. And this was just too big, too many people.
You might not be back.
No, I won't go back to it. Look, you know, it's a bit more of a suburban festival as opposed to the kind of like a fringe festival, which is where I prefer to be. I prefer to be on the fringes with interesting people as opposed to mainstream sort of stuff. And this was very mainstream. There were some good bands. The main reason I went was there were some good bands playing, but most of the bands that I wanted to see were cancelled. They were on the Friday, and they cancelled the Friday. I wanted to see, Wet Leg was who I wanted to see, but they got cancelled.
So, Kevin, we have got so much to talk about.
I know. Okay. So, enough of my troubles. What have we got planned for the show today, Anne?
Well, you know how we do have a newish federal government at the moment, and you and I do like to keep our eye on what the federal government does because they have the special power of the public purse. The federal government is the currency issuer, so we like to keep our eye on them. And the federal government, as a new government, now how long has it been since Labor was in power? I was trying to think.
Rudd-Gillard-Rudd government was from 2007 to 2013.
Yeah, so it's been a decade that they had to hold off, and then I think they've spent that decade making a laundry list. So they've been very busy there in Canberra in these last few weeks. So I thought we might have a look at some of the things they've been doing with the public purse.
Rightio.
Or not doing, in fact, because just back in August the 30th, so on August the 30th, our new social services minister, Amanda Rishworth, She made an announcement very clearly that unfortunately she could not increase the unemployment payments.
Couldn't increase the unemployment payments.
No, where they are at half the poverty level.
Half the poverty level is where they have to stay for some strange reason.
Mm. Well, the reason she gave, you wouldn't believe it, it was the trillion-dollar debt. So let's have a listen to Amanda in her own words saying why she can't raise the rate.
No worries.
Just on the job seeker rate, you are the Minister for Social Services. ACOS has called for a big increase. Is that something that you are looking at?
Well, look, we've been really clear about the rate of job seeker.
Current Social Services Minister Amanda Rishworth speaking with Patricia Karvelis on ABC's Radio National Breakfast, broadcast 30th of August 2022.
We've been really clear that at the moment, in the October budget, this is not something that we're going to proceed with. Of course, as we've said, we'll assess it at budget by budget. And if there is room in the budget, of course, that's how we have to deal with a whole lot of competing measures. So, look, that's the challenge of being given or inheriting $1 trillion worth of debt.
My job is to paint the true picture of the economy and our economic challenges.
Treasurer Jim Chalmers.
That $1 trillion of debt in the budget. Every additional dollar in the budget is a borrowed dollar. The $1 trillion of debt that we inherited from our predecessors. The budget is absolutely heaving. $1 trillion in debt. Liberal debt. Public debt. Government debt. 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 Government debt. We have to be upfront with people. We can't do everything that we would like to do. We can't even afford the good ideas that people put to us.
Oh, man.
That's just the reality.
Essentially, your portfolio is dealing with some of the poorest people in our country. Don't they deserve assistance now, not the richest people in Australia?
Right now, I'm really focused on the issues that are affecting my portfolio and looking at ways forward. And I'm really looking forward to the discussion at the Job Summit.
So,
hold me back, Anne. Hold me back.
Before we get onto the Job Summit, I just love talking points that the politicians come out with. So when you hear more than one minister use the same phrase, $1 trillion debt, you know that that's going to be their no-go zone. That's going to be their non-negotiable zone.
Why are they doing this? I mean, Labor have been under so much punishment from the Conservatives for running deficits. Now they have a perfect opportunity to blow this out of the water, to say deficits do not matter. Tony Abbott got in 2013, with this debt and deficit disaster bullshit. Mm-hmm. And it was all about how the deficit was going to ruin the country and be doing our kids. Nah, 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 nah. Uh-huh. And then successive Turnbull and Morrison governments blew the deficit out of the water and were raving about their debt to GDP ratio being fine and the AAA credit rating being fine, basically saying deficits don't matter.
Mm-hmm.
And why Labor then wants to go back to this battleground and say deficits do matter?
Oh, well, I think they're using it as an excuse. They can pull it out of their back pocket just whenever they want to. So they're not pulling it out, for example, if they want to put $1 billion into the TAFE system. Suddenly we don't have to worry about the debt.
No.
But when it's a policy they don't want to do, then they can pull it out and wave it around and scare all those unemployed people off with this $1 trillion
debt. Why don't they want to help the unemployed people out? What's wrong with them? I mean, look, I've been reading the 1945 H.C. Coombs white paper.
Ooh.
And we'll go into this later on.
We'll talk about that, yeah.
But the difference in attitude about government responsibility to look after their unemployed and to make sure that people had work, the attitude back then is so contrasting to now, where it's a question of how much shall we punish the unemployed for their plight.
If I was being very generous with them, I'd say maybe what they're trying to do is see how their policies that have come out of this Jobs and Skills Summit see how those work to get the unemployment rate down before they start increasing payments. But what we're hearing from Amanda Rishworth is it's not going to be, there's going to be no raising of the rate in the upcoming October budget, which means we won't see the rate raised for at least a year until the next budget. And I'm just waiting for Amanda. Amanda, if you're listening, can you do me a favour and just keep saying that the budget is heaving with the coalition debt? I just love that image of the budget heaving. I've just got this image of all the ministers like bent over the toilets in Canberra, just heaving with this $1 trillion debt.
It doesn't matter. Debt does not matter.
Now, do you mind explaining, in case anyone hasn't been listening to us before, Kevin, do you mind just explaining exactly what this debt is?
Well, the debt is what the government has spent into the economy and hasn't extracted back out through taxation.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a government contribution to the economy. And the US economy, they've been running deficits and debt for 180 years.
Yes.
And they're held up as the poster child of a magnificent economy. And it's all based on government injecting currency into the economy.
So another way to describe this money that is $1 trillion worth is to say, well, actually, that's the money supply that is in the economy. It's not a debt in the way you and I would think of a debt. If you borrowed $100 off me, you would be in $100 debt to me.
Yeah.
But the government is not in debt to anyone because they do not have to borrow the money because they are the currency issuer.
They create the currency.
But they do an operation. They do some paperwork that makes them look like they have borrowed the money. So they actually do this thing, and I hate to say it, I hate to mention the word, but we have to mention the word bonds. So let's say the government had spent $100 million into the economy, and then it taxed back out through income tax or whatever else, it taxed back out $25 million. That would mean there was $75 million floating around out there in the economy. And then what the government could just leave it at that. They could just say, we've spent the money, that's great, now it's in the economy doing what it needs to do.
Not only could they, that's what they do. We have $1 trillion worth of debt because that's exactly what the government has done.
That's what the money is doing.
Yeah.
But then they do this little extra thing that they don't have to do, but they do it anyway. And one of the reasons they do it is it's a holdover from the old gold standard system. But what they do is they say, well, we've got this $75 million we've spent into the economy. So what we also have to do now is sell $75 million worth of bonds. Now, in any other situation when someone is selling bonds, it is, in fact, a borrowing operation. So anybody else like a state government or a local government or a company, if they're selling bonds, what they're doing is saying, can you give me your $100 and I'll give you this bit of paper that says this is a bond worth $100 and I'll owe you a bit of money on top of that, which is the interest. So it looks like borrowing. And so in any other situation, selling bonds is borrowing. But when it comes to the federal government, they're a special case and they're not actually borrowing. So then you might want to ask yourself, well, why would the federal government issue bonds if it's not borrowing money? And the reason it does this is to manage interest rates. And that's a whole other story. We won't go into it.
Yep.
And what it is doing, it's what the economists call, I love this phrase, they call it soaking up the liquidity in the economy. And I always imagine someone with a big mop soaking up all this liquidity.
So bonds are presented as this false sense of borrowing, the government borrowing money.
Mm-hmm.
It's not. Yeah. And a perfect example of this is that if a government runs a surplus, they don't need to borrow money through bonds, do they?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's exactly what happened in the early 2000s with Howard and Costello. The Howard government ran surpluses, which means there's no need to issue any bonds.
Absolutely no need.
And what happened? All the financial institutions went nuts and said, hey, we want our bonds, we want our bonds. And we've mentioned this before. That tells you the true nature of bonds. The bonds are something which help out institutional investors.
Well, it gives them a risk-free investment because they know that the government can always pay the interest on those bonds. And so when Jim Chalmers says, the rising cost of servicing government debt is what is holding the budget back. What he's talking about is the interest that they're paying on these bonds. And the thing we know is because the Australian government issues the dollars, it can always issue the dollars to pay whatever the interest is, and that will not affect their ability to pay for anything else. For example, to raise the rate of unemployment benefits from where they are at half the poverty line up to the poverty line and pull millions of people out of poverty.
Long and short of it, Anne, is that if the government was to extend its so-called deficit by raising the rate, it wouldn't matter. All it would do would be to make people's lives easier. That's all. It would help stimulate the economy. You'd have money moving from the government sector into the private sector via people on welfare, and it would just make their lives easier. They'd then be able to go to the shop, buy things that they need, a new couch, a new fridge, tyres for their car. That helps business, and you stimulate the economy. And this is all done on the back of a deficit, just like we've been doing for decades, just like the US economy has been doing for nearly 200 years. That's how it works.
Yeah, so it's really hard for me to understand why the Labor government is being so reluctant about this. The only other thing I can think is maybe they're worried that they would increase in the already increasing inflation if they put extra spending power into people's hands who will do the spending. I don't think that's a very good excuse, though.
Giving people who are living on half the poverty line a bit of money so that they can get by is hardly going to be inflationary. That's just going to be honest, you know, and at the same time, of course, they're talking about giving this tax break to people earning up to $200,000. Now, that's inflationary because that goes into housing and with the low interest rates and all the other tax offsets. That's inflated the house prices. So we are seeing inflation through government spending because they're targeting it wrong. They're giving people with a lot of money more money to push up the prices of houses so they can buy the house, buy a holiday house, buy a couple of investment properties, and they're competing against regular people who are just trying to put a roof over their head. Now that's inflationary and that's really bad policy. And both parties, both sides of government seem keen on perpetuating this ridiculous cycle of inflationary policy. But giving people on half the poverty line an even break just so that they can, which is exactly what they did during COVID.
We saw them do it with the coronavirus supplement, which doubled the unemployment rate overnight. So we know that they could roll this policy out overnight if they wanted to.
Because they've done it already.
Kevin, I think you need a bit of a break here.
Oh, yeah, right here. Okay, so one of the good things that I did do when I went to Splendor in the Mud was that there were some good bands playing. One of them was King Stingray. I love King Stingray. And they played. I saw them in a marquee. The marquees were even flooded. I was up to my... I was in this marquee. It's got plush velvet drapes and there's chandeliers and there's King Stingray playing. Oh. And we're all in the mud. It was just like unbelievable. I'm just trying to find it because I put it somewhere. So hang on, give me 2 seconds. Okay. Now, this is a song. I love King Stingray. They got a really good response. Mm-hmm. But, you hear songs about love and life and stuff. This is a song called Camp Dog. It's about a dog that bites people.
Thank you. you're angry, but please don't take this out on me. I'm just trying to get back home in one piece. Looking at me, I know you think you're king of the community, king of the street. Can't talk, please, please don't bite me. Holler me, or did you mean it when you chased me? Showing your teeth.
Ross House has community meeting rooms available for hire at subsidised rates. Perfect for small meetings, student study groups, Zoom conferencing and seminars. Facilities include free Wi-Fi, display screens for presentations, projector and sound system and a Zoom conferencing system. HEPA filter units have been placed in every meeting room. You can book and pay via their website, rosshouse.org.au, or contact reception during office hours on 9650 1599. Ross House is a 3CR supporter.
The revolution in Rojava is a beacon of hope for the world, putting direct democracy and feminism into practice on a broad scale. This radical attempt at social transformation now faces huge challenges, including daily attacks by the Turkish military with little outside recognition or aid. Show your support for Rojava by joining Northeast Syria Solidarity, or NESS, and help ensure the survival of this inspiring experiment in social change. NESS sends aid, raises awareness, and builds solidarity. Get involved at www.nesssolidarity.org.au. NESS is a 3CR supporter.
You're listening to Unemployed Workers Fight Back, a show all about the economics and experience
of unemployment and underemployment
here on 3CR Community Radio.
Well, thanks for sticking with us as Kevin and I poke around in the macro economy. Now, Kevin, if ever anyone's words were going to come back to haunt them, it must be the words that Alan Tudge spoke.
Channel 9's A Current Affair looked back to the 5th of December 2016, when a statement about Centrelink's debt recovery scheme was made by Alan Tudge, then Human Services Minister.
We will find you, we will track you down, and you will have to repay those debts, and you may end up in prison.
There has been an overwhelming success in terms of the new debt recovery system.
Christian Porter, then Social Services Minister, on ABC Background Briefing, March 2017.
Monies are being identified and being paid back to the taxpayer, indeed $300 million so far, with a tiny complaint rate.
So, tell me in a few words, what's the reason for your call?
Debt recovery.
Maybe a little differently. You can say things like information on childcare or my superannuation entitlements. So in a few words, what's the reason for your call?
Debt recovery.
We haven't been able to determine the reason for your inquiry. Thanks for calling the Department of Human Services. Goodbye.
Wow.
YouTube content creator, Scruffy Looking Nerf Herder, October 2017.
We are doing this in an organised, fair and procedural way.
Christian Porter, then Social Services Minister, on ABC News, January 2017.
Where if there is an explanation for a discrepancy that has arisen, you can go online very simply and sort that explanation out.
And I think that we want to make sure that we have a system which is reasonable to the recipient.
Then Human Services Minister Alan Tudge on ABC's Background Briefing, March 2017.
And also fair and reasonable to the taxpayer who is paying for the welfare system in its entirety.
But is the Labor Party position actually that we should not go out and successfully recover $4 billion worth of overpayments?
Christian Porter.
We will find you, we will track you down, and you will have to repay those debts, and you may end up in prison.
Alan Tudge.
I'd just like to answer Christian Porter's question there about what the Labor government thinks that they should do about chasing after unemployed people for all these debts. And in fact, the reason why we're looking at this and what that was all about was, of course, this thing called the robo-debts, which was an automated income data matching algorithm that was unleashed upon unemployed people back in 2016. And now here we are in 2020 and Anthony Albanese, our Australian Prime Minister, bless his cotton socks, he's actually announced a royal commission into what went on with these robo-debts.
And Bill Shorten is right behind this as well. So, you know, I know people don't like politicians, but when they do good things, I don't care who they are, if Albanese and Shorten are addressing this issue, this victimisation, this targeting of unemployed, good on them. You know, like if you're going to criticise them, you've got to tip your hat to them when they're doing the right thing
That's
well.
That's right. And in fact, I wouldn't mind doing just a little recap on what went on with this robo-debt so that we can understand why this robo-debt has attracted one ombudsman's report back in April 2017, not one but two Senate inquiries through 2017 to 2019, and it was the Senate inquiries that actually recommended they do a royal commission. And also what went on, or what this robo-debt inspired, was a class action suit against the federal government that actually resulted in a $1.8 billion settlement, which included repaying $700 million back to the over 430,000 people who had these debts raised against them.
Just let's just think about that for a second. You talk about people living on half the poverty line who have had to go through this, I don't know, what do you call it, just this process of having what little they have taken from them unfairly.
Yes.
Because a lot of this was like the algorithm. You can get some pretty good algorithms these days, but that one must have been a shocker because you're allowed to earn money. That's the whole point. If you get a job, you're unemployed and you get some casual work, that means you're earning, which is good, and the algorithm couldn't pick it up.
Let me just give you some details on this algorithm, Kevin, just so people can understand how horrendous this thing was. So here's one example of how the algorithm was working. So what they were doing is there was two different departments. There's the department that was known as Centrelink, which was paying unemployed workers, and unemployed workers had to record their income with Centrelink. They had to report it. So they had that series of data. And then also people have to report their income to the Australian Tax Office. So the Tax Office had its set of data, and what they were doing was matching the two sets of data. So one of the things this algorithm did, and they were matching the data to see if people were not really reporting income. So they thought they were chasing what they call welfare cheats. So what this algorithm did was that if the ATO had recorded the employer's name differently from the employer name that you used to report your income to Centrelink, the system counted that income twice, right? So if you earned $300, say, and you said I earned it at, say, McDonald's, and then, in fact, the ATO actually calls McDonald's McDonald's Incorporation, and that was two different names, and it looked like you'd earned $600.
Oh, boy. So it's a really dumb algorithm.
Oh, yeah.
Probably on purpose, you'd have to imagine.
Well, you wonder. And that's what this Royal Commission might find out. There's another example of how bad this is. So Centrelink itself says that sometimes you don't have to declare income. For example, if you get a job termination payment. So, you know, when people finish their jobs and they'll get like a few $1,000 or whatever, the algorithm thought you did have to report it.
Right.
So there were all these false overpayments that the algorithm was spotting, and then it's sending out these debt notices to people who had to deal with it. And as we heard in that little clip, you'd try and phone Centrelink and you would get no help at all in trying to deal with this. Now, the inquiry is going to be looking for some answers about what was going on. So they're going to look at who was responsible for designing and implementing this scheme. So Alan and Christian, we will find you. We will track you down.
Christian Porter, he's pretty squeaky clean, though. He hasn't got too much to worry about, has he?
They will also be looking at why repeated warnings that this was incorrectly issuing people with debt notices were ignored. They will be looking into how the complaints were handled. And this is why it's so important to have the Royal Commission, even after the inquiries and after the court case, which is they're going to look at the harm that it did to people, including over 2,000 suspected deaths, including death by suicide.
It's just, it just leaves you speechless. It's part of this whole program to victim blame and to make life hard for people who are doing it hard. It is such a contrast to where we were back in 1945 with this white paper, which just lays out that it's government's responsibility to, this was with the returning servicemen, et cetera, but it was government's responsibility to create the environment whereby people who are doing it hard can find a way out. And what we find now is the complete opposite. What we do is we have a reserve pool of people unemployed to keep downward pressure on wages, and we kick them when they're down.
That's right. That's right.
It's just inhumane.
So, yeah, it's cruel and unusual. And I find it kind of interesting how the energy with which they were pursuing people, for example, someone who'd gotten $5,000 in Social Security benefits 6 years ago and, you know, their only crime was actually to get a casual job and their only mistake was to actually be honest and report that they had that income. But the zeal with which they pursued these people, compare that to how there's been very little interest in recovering the JobKeeper overpayments.
Yeah.
Now, these were payments that went to employers during the pandemic. Altogether, there was $90 billion spent on JobKeeper, and I've read reports that it was about $20 billion of that was in overpayments.
Can I just, while it's fresh in my mind, just give you an example of how that's been absolutely exploited? And there's all this stuff about Qantas at the moment and the baggage handlers. So baggage handlers were traditionally employed full-time, 8 hours a day to do their job. It's hard work, it's physical work, but, you know, you could work 8 hours a day and you could pay off a mortgage and live a life. That's now been outsourced, and they're contracted out in 4-hour shifts now. So if you're a baggage handler now, you're externally contracted out, and you turn up for half a day. And that's so now we've seen full time wages turn into casual wages. This is insecurity in earnings, etc. It's the casualization of
this
the workforce.
Extending that gig economy
idea. And this is what Joyce and Qantas did after all of the government assistance they got to keep people employed was they kicked them in the teeth. So those guys, all fine, no problems, that's all great.
Yeah.
But people who are living on half the poverty line, who get a bit of work and the computer glitch, the algorithm is wrong, let's go after them. Let's hunt them down. What was the Tudor saying? Hunt them down and make them pay and possibly send them to jail.
We'll find you and you possibly will end up in prison.
Yeah, no.
So I'm really looking forward to going back in time when life was a bit kinder and welfare was a bit kinder with that white paper. Shall we?
Let's have a quick break. Now, you know, I like going to festivals, and I went to Splendor in the Mud and saw King Stingray. That was good. There was a couple of good bands there, but overall.
I just am imagining you sloshing around in these tents.
I was there for like 4 or 5 days, and I was there with my festival buddy Nick, and we were just saying, oh, mate. You had to be there. People will talk about this, you know, like the actor, the performers, they're on stage and they're talking about the mud. They weren't there, man. They weren't there down in the mud. I saw a guy who's walking along. His boot just got lost in the mud.
His boot got sucked into the
mud. I tried to pull it
mud.
Out, but he couldn't come. He didn't walk up without his boot. So that was that. Anyway, now, long-term listeners of our show might realise that I'm also involved in the Lockhart Music Festival, which is at the complete opposite spectrum of the festival dynamic. So there was, I think there was 50,000 people at Splendour in the Mud. There'll be 1,500 people at Lockhart. Maybe
a town versus a little village.
Yeah. Maybe 2,500 if we're lucky. And it's just been announced, so I would encourage people to check out the Lockhart Music Festival. They're still finding their feet, so I don't mind giving them a free plug.
All local bands, isn't it?
Mainly local bands, yes. Mm-hmm. In fact, they're all local bands. When I say local, some come from Sydney. I mean, we're not talking international stuff.
From the border.
But they keep on cracking up-and-coming bands. And so one of them is a band called Digital Africa.
Thank you.
So that was Digital Africa with Discotheque Africa. And they're playing at the Lockout Music Festival, which is on in late November. I think it's the 18th to the 19th to the 20th of November. Nice little boutique festival down towards Port something, Princetown, down, you know, like on the south coast.
Of Victoria.
Yes, southwest Victoria. Anyway, there you go. Now, let's wind up the show and by talking about things like, we'll continue this theme of the victimisation of the unemployed and how it's utilised as a weapon to keep wages down under the guise of keeping inflation down. But I'm calling that as complete bullshit. It's just not true. So we've talked about this many times before, the non-accelerating inflation rate of unemployment. And this is a very, very different beast to what happened in the 1945 white paper. I've got some notes here.
I'm really interested that the Labor government is referring back to this paper. This is like a really pivotal kind of piece of thinking that was all set down in one document.
It's kind of you and I, we like to think that we're, you know, progressive and modern and up to date with stuff. I'm reading this white paper, and this is 75 years ago, and it leaves us in its tracks. Okay. It says in there, it says, unemployment is an evil. Commonwealth and state governments are obliged to and owe the Australian people the responsibility to maintain conditions of full employment. Now, when they talk about full employment, they're talking about full employment.
They mean full employment. They mean no involuntary unemployment, whereas these days...
They specifically say that there'll be some unemployment. There'll be people who are in between jobs, who might take time off to look after, you know, relatives, or might be in training. So there's valid reasons. It's not just people languishing about, but anybody who wants a job should have a job, and it's the government's responsibility to provide the conditions that create that. Mm-hmm. Now we have the non-accelerating inflation rate of unemployment, and what it says is that we need to have a pool of unemployed people, hungry and starving, desperate, so that anybody else who's working will fear being unemployed, and so we'll always have more unemployed people than there are jobs available. And people, workers, will do what they're told, because if they don't, they could end up unemployed. One of those unemployed people will come and take their job in 2 seconds flat because they're starving and desperate.
So workers will be too scared to ask for a wage rise, and if there are no wage rises, you won't have inflation.
Well, this is the other fallacy, is that they're saying that inflation is tied to wages, that if wages go up, inflation will go up. Mm. Now, okay, there might be some truth to that, but there has to be other conditions applying. Like, for instance, at the moment they're saying, let's avoid the wages spiral that we had during the 70s when we had the oil blowout. So the cost of oil goes up, everything goes up because everything requires transport. And then the unions were strong and they said, right, well, if the prices are going up, we need to increase our wages in line with inflation. And that means that if they're producing stuff, and this was back when the economy was a lot more labour intensive than it is now. People made things, not robots back then. So if you've got people who are making things and they're earning more money, then that means that the cost of producing that item goes up, which means you have this.
So your labour costs were higher in the economy. But of course, what we talked about on a previous show is there's many different causes of inflation, and you have to be very careful about what's causing inflation.
Yeah, but it wasn't the wages spiral that caused the inflation of the 70s. It was the oil.
It was the oil shock.
Now, the unions are weak. We have a lot more automation. So if people aren't producing stuff, for instance, I worked at a mob called Robotic Automation for a while, and they provided the assembly lines and robots for places like, it was called Sorbent originally, and originally in that warehouse, in that manufacturing plant, there were hundreds of people on the production lines. Now there's about half a dozen sitting in the towers watching the conveyor belts and the robots do everything. So if the price of oil goes up and then wages go up to try and keep up with it, you're only talking about six people asking for a wage rise, not hundreds. and so it's not going to affect the price of those paper products.
Right.
Like they are not going to be affected by a wages spiral because we have a lot more automation now.
Okay.
So the real purpose of the NAIRU is to keep wages down, but it's not to stop inflation. It's to increase profits.
Mm.
This is what gets me about this whole inflation episode. Is everybody saying, "Oh, we need to control and regulate wages so that we don't have out of control inflation," but they don't talk about regulating or controlling the people who are price gouging, which is the cause of the actual inflation.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
Oh, that's okay. You know, it's like they say, you know, look, greed is natural. And there's nothing you can do about it, and it's good for the economy. Well, greed is natural. Like getting bitten by a snake is natural, right? But if I get bitten by a snake, I don't just go, "Oh, I just got bitten by a snake. That's natural. I'll just let it go." No, I suck at the venom and go and try and find an antidote.
Yeah, that's one of the amazing things you discover when you start getting into this economics and understanding what's gone on historically, is that you see how they use these excuses to get what they want. Like right now, they're using the excuse of the trillion-dollar debt,
yep,
and they're using the excuse of inflation. And back then, they were using the excuse of inflation.
It's absolute nonsense. What's more, the non-accelerating inflation rate of unemployment is this arbitrary figure that they pull out of their ass. You know, they do. They say, "Oh, inflation's we've got unemployment running at 6.57%, and inflation is under control. Therefore, the NIRU is 6.5%." And then it drops, and they go, "Well, we still haven't got inflation, so now the NIRU is 5%.
Yes, yes.
And now it's down to 3.something%. We still haven't got inflation. They go, "Oh, well, the NIRU is now 3%. Well, they're not.
It's a retrospective that's figure, isn't it? That's they're like pulling out of the air.
That's like that Simpsons episode where what's the
sniff that other dog. Is that the one?
No, the one about the rock. Lisa. So Lisa is trying to explain to Homer the logic, saying, "Homer, that's like saying, because there's that rock on the nature strip, there's no tigers in the neighbourhood. So, you know, you're correlating two things." Yeah, yeah. And of course, Homer goes, "Well, don't move the rock, you know."
I'm thinking of the one where Bart was training the dog.
Yeah.
And he's like showing off his training skills, and the dog sort of walks over and lifts its leg on a tree. So Bart's going, "Lift that leg, pee on that tree."
Exactly. So the way I think about the NIRU is it's kind of like, you know, how the Aztecs used to have human sacrifice,
yes,
right, to appease the gods.
True.
The conservative, the orthodox economists are prepared to sacrifice unemployed to the scrap heap to appease the inflation gods.
Inflation gods.
There is no data to support it. It's all just gobbledygook.
And really, the inflation gods are really hiding this profit seeking.
Yeah, it's done under the guise of keeping inflation under control, but really it's about increasing profits, and that's why we've seen since the 1970s this disparity between we had a nice linear graph where as productivity rose and as profits rose, wages rose alongside the profits. It was all in line. That was pretty linear from 1945 to 1975.
Mm-hmm.
As the productivity increases, produced more for everybody, it was shared equally with the workers and with the shareholders, etc.
That factory you described where they've got six people and a bunch of robots, that's an example of how your productivity increases because it takes less people to produce the same or more amount of whatever that thing was producing.
Yeah, and robots are unreal. Like they do it at 10 times the rate. So that factory would have had a big infrastructure expenditure spike when they bought the robots, and then afterwards the curve would have seen that the wages that they weren't paying would have come to a point where the robots then became profitable, and you'll see the profits increase.
We'll have to have a show, I think, one day about productivity and innovation. But in the meantime, was there anything else in the white paper?
Well, the white paper, I didn't get the whole way through it. The reason was because I was telling a friend whose room I was in, "You should read this paper. It's unbelievable." She couldn't care. She was watching something else. But
it's so progressive sounding. Well, and that was written, the lead author on that was Nugget Coombs.
H.C. Coombs.
Yes.
So they reckon and this all came out of World War II. So they said between 1919 and 1939, there was kind of like a regular 10% unemployment. And that during the Depression, that rose to
25%. 25% unemployment.
Yeah.
Huge.
So, yeah. And what they did back then was that when the economy went downwards, the government went into austerity mode. And they recognised that this was completely the wrong thing to do.
Just on that level of unemployment too, one thing I think about is how our current, or at least pre-pandemic, the youth unemployment rate, so for under 25s, it was around 23%. So I often think about how our younger Australians are living through a constant depression in that sense.
Yeah, yeah. It's constantly there. I could go on and on about this white paper, and I'll try and refer back to it.
Yeah.
But we've had this job summit just recently, mm-hmm. and one of the things that we go on about modern monetary theory, and we should maybe drop a few hints, the fact that we're going to rebrand our show at some stage in the future.
We might be moving into a new room.
we're going to go, this is Unemployed Workers Fight Back, and there's a lot of overlap between modern monetary theory and unemployed workers' rights.
Unemployment is a macroeconomic phenomenon.
Yeah, and one of the main pillars to address the unemployment problem through modern monetary theory is the job guarantee, where the government, very much in line with the 1945 white paper, takes the responsibility to make sure that everybody's employed. And so the chief economist who we refer to is a fellow called Professor Bill Mitchell, and he has pioneered this job guarantee idea,
mm-hmm.
Which would fit perfectly with this 1945 white paper. Mm. And it's all about making sure that everybody who wants a job can have a job at the minimum wage.
Mm.
And that is sponsored by the government. And so when there's times of unemployment, the government takes up the slack, and then you have people who are job ready to move from the government sector to the private sector when the private sector picks up steam.
So one idea that was noticeably absent from the Jobs and Skills Summit that was recently held by our new Labor government is the idea of the job guarantee. It was sorely missing.
It would solve so many problems. You know, like sure, there's all the training to address, etc., but that could also be done through the jobs guarantee. You could be paid a minimum wage as an apprentice, and they're talking about how the apprenticeship wages are too low. So put apprentices on the minimum wage so that they can afford to live. They're getting trained, and bingo, you've got apprentices, and they're done through the job guarantee. You've got the casualisation of the workforce, the gig economy. Tony Burke's going big on the gig workers at the moment. He's mm-hmm. really he's got that in his sights, because the gig economy is basically just stripping low paid casual workers of any rights. No minimum wage, no sick leave, no superannuation. Basically, you're just shipping them out to the lowest bidder. Job guarantee would fix that problem immediately. Nobody would work as a gig worker if they could get a job at the minimum wage, unless it suited them. And so there's some people like some people who are retirees or students who need just a bit of in-between work. Hey, if you want to go and do some in-between work under those circumstances, go for your life. But there's a job for you at the minimum wage if you want it instead.
So what we're talking about is getting to full employment. And I always think there's three main things you do. You do the job guarantee. You also expand or refund the defunded public service. So you're giving people career jobs within sorely needed areas in the public service. And you also spend properly into the economy. When you do all those three things, you'll get to full employment. But in the meantime, the government and everybody else, the businesses, are clamouring about this skills shortage. And I spoke to one of our MMT economists recently, and he was pointing out to me how there's a difference between a labour shortage and a skills shortage, which I thought was very interesting. So what he was pointing out was that we have a lot of unemployed or underemployed people. The underemployment rate probably still involves about 1 million people in this country. And so what he's saying is that it's not that we don't have workers, it's that we have a skills mismatch.
Yeah, and I reckon that's been done on purpose by the Conservatives to de-skill your labour force, bring in overseas workers, bring in the gig economy. It's all about undermining workers' security to make them mean lean, which increases profits, which goes to the top end of town, and workers miss out.
Yeah, I think the two things we have when you have work, when you have employers clamouring for labour, and interestingly, this is often in places like the hospitality industry, I think you've got two problems. You've got a wages shortage and you've got a skills shortage. So what you've got is jobs where you're not attracting people into them, because who was filling those jobs before? It was your temporary migrant workforce, who were probably being paid far less than the minimum wage.
Yeah.
And local workers, resident workers, do not want to work for, you know, low pay
It's been a race to the bottom for quite some time. But, you know, look, there's so much to talk about here, Anne, but I think we're going to have to push a lot of this conversation over to the next show because we're running out of time.
Quickly before we go, Can I just mention, we mentioned Professor Bill Mitchell. Now, he is the founder of the economics that you and I hang our hats on, Kevin.
Yep.
And anywhere you are in the world, if you've got a working computer and you've got an internet connection, you can jump online and do his free 4-week course, which is starting in September the 14th, runs to October the 12th. And the website to go to is edx.org. So edx.org, it's what they call a MOOC. So it's an online, free online course, and it's called Modern Monetary Theory, Economics for the 21st Century. So if you go to that edx.org and just type in MMT, you'll find it. And it's a fabulous course. We've both done it. It's free. You may as well go ahead and do it. And
it's surprisingly easy. You think about this economic stuff being complicated. This is what this fella does is
Economics for the everyman, every woman.
Like you understand it, and you can have these conversations. And what underpins all of this is we've got to stop saying the debt and deficit. That's putting a handbrake on everything. You've got to understand this shit. It's important.
And I'll quickly mention Modern Money Lab, who are starting up in September as well. Those are for postgraduates. So if you know anyone out there who's done an undergraduate degree in economics and they've come out shattered and had all their visions of making the world a better place completely broken, they need to go off and do one of these graduate programs at the Modern Money Lab, which is located at the Torrens University in Adelaide, but also online.
And that's Stephen Hale and co. They're two great people. We got to go because there's people knocking at the door. We're going to pick up this conversation again in a couple of weeks' time. But until then, see you later.
See you then.
You've been listening to Unemployed Workers Fight Back.
Join us the second and fourth Friday of each and every month as part of the Sewer Show on 3CR.
Listen to this show as a podcast by going to 3cr.org.au.
We thank all our guests, and I thank you, Anne.
And I thank you, Kevin.
Oh, no, the pleasure was all mine.
Oh, no, Kevin, the pleasure was all mine.
You mean all the pleasure was yours?
Kevin, I think I took all the pleasure on this one.
Well, if you took all the pleasure, that means there's no pleasure for me at all. I quite enjoyed myself. So if you've got all the pleasure, then what, I had no pleasure?
I think we should share the pleasure.
Well, we're going to have to share the pleasure because, you know, I don't mind you having pleasure. That's great. So you have as much pleasure as you like, but don't take all the pleasure.
Well, it was very pleasurable. So I'm glad that it was pleasurable for you and it was pleasurable for me. I think we've got a multiplier of pleasure here.
It's doubly pleasurable. So if it was pleasurable for you in the first place, and it was pleasurable for me, well, it's twice as pleasurable as before. That's a good thing.
Double the pleasure. What could go wrong?
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.